The headlines, Russia warns that possible delivery of U.S.-made battle tanks to Ukraine would be a blatant provocation. U.S. President Joe Biden once again calls on Congress to ban assault weapons after back-to-back mass shootings across the country. And North Korea places the capital Pyongyang on a five-day lockdown over rising cases of an unspecified respiratory illness. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of third-generation Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine, saying the weapons would burn in Ukraine. Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has also reacted. He called the delivery of the tanks a blatant provocation against Moscow. Antonov also accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Moscow. The U.S. is poised to announce the start of the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. In the meantime, Germany has also bowed to pressure from Western allies and agreed to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine. Both countries are expected to announce the decision later today in a video address. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said tanks transfer talks must end with the decision, adding that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. He reiterated his claim that Russia is planning a new wave of aggression, with the first signs being visible in the Donbass region. In recent weeks, Russia has also filled up pressure on the eastern Ukrainian town of Bakhmut, claiming a number of successes in its military campaign there. EU foreign ministers rubber stamp an additional 500 million euros in military support for Ukraine. This as peace activists call on the bloc's leaders to take a different approach. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional 500 million euro military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. President Joe Biden is once again urging Congress to ban assault weapons after back-to-back deadly shootings across the country.
And we're working out a number of things that we can and are going to be doing. So the bottom line here is that we got a lot to talk about. And yesterday, my buddy Dianne Feinstein introduced her Senate assault weapons ban. I am asking you all to send that to my desk as quickly as you can.
Several states, including California, Ohio, and Washington, have experienced shooting incidents in recent weeks. The deadliest unfolded in California, where three separate gun assaults left 24 people dead. Figures from a research database, the Gun Violence Archive, show there have been more than 600 mass shootings in the United States in the last 3 years, almost two a day on average. Biden's push for a ban on assault weapons is not likely to bear results, as Republicans now in control of the House of Representatives are mostly opposed to such measures. The Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gives Americans the right to bear arms, and about a third of adults in the country say they personally own a gun. Also in the U.S., former Vice President Mike Pence is the latest high-ranking politician to be put into the spotlight for the discovery of classified documents. The files were found at Pence's Indiana residence and turned over to the FBI last week. His representative says a small number of records were accidentally boxed and transported to his home as he left office in 2021. It's not clear what information the documents contain. The discovery comes in the wake of similar revelations about classified material discovered in President Joe Biden's private office and also the Florida residence of former President Donald Trump. Records from each administration are supposed to be turned over to the legal custody of the U.S. National Archives during the presidential transition period. It's unlawful to knowingly remove or retain classified material. The U.S. administration has granted a license to Trinidad and Tobago to develop a major gas field located in Venezuela's territorial waters. The move marks a further easing of some of Washington's sanctions on Caracas. The U.S. Treasury said it issued the license at the request of Trinidad. The license allows the island nation to do business with Venezuela's heavily sanctioned state-run oil company, PDVSA. This, as a Venezuelan company has found reserves of 4.2 trillion cubic feet in the area. U.S. officials say granting the license helps ensure energy security and reduces the region's reliance on energy resources from other countries, including Russia. Western countries have seen an increasing scarcity in oil and gas supplies, exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. The easing of oil sanctions on Venezuela is also seen as an extension of Western efforts to tap into the country's vast oil and gas reserves. Peru's president has called for a national truce to end weeks of unrest against the backdrop of demands for her resignation and fresh elections.
We call for a truce. We call the Congress, and now I call my dear homeland, for a national truce to establish the dialogue tables and, better still, to be able to set the agenda for each region and develop our peoples.
President Boluarte said she will not back down from the path of dialogue, peace, and unity. The Peruvian head of state ruled out resignation but said that she has no intention for remaining in power. Boluarte said weeks of deadly protests have resulted in more than $1.3 billion in damage. The protests in Peru began in December after then-President Pedro Castillo was arrested and replaced by his vice president, Dina Boluarte. Protesters also want Castillo released. Some 50 people have been killed during the disturbances. Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including the creation of a common currency. The announcement came as Brazilian President Lula da Silva visited Argentina on his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernandez, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries, so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister, Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive.
The imposition of U.S. trade restrictions and sanctions against a number of countries, including Russia, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, Iraq, and Syria, have been ineffective and backfired against Western economies. As a result, the U.S. dollar has been losing its role as a major currency in international trade transactions. This provides a unique opportunity for regional currencies and alternative payment systems to fill the vacuum, just like what Argentina and Brazil are planning to do.
Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the U.S. and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the U.S. dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of U.S. dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the U.S. dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of U.S. dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999. While the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like SCO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the U.S. dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years.
North Korean authorities have ordered a 5-day lockdown for the capital, Pyongyang, as the city is witnessing a rise in cases of an unspecified respiratory illness. A South Korean news outlet reported the measure, citing a notice from the North Korean government. The notice didn't mention COVID-19, but said residents were required to stay indoors until Sunday. They also have to submit temperature checks multiple times every day. The outlet had earlier reported that Pyongyang residents were appeared to be stocking up food and other essentials in anticipation of stricter measures. Pyongyang had acknowledged its worst coronavirus outbreak in 2022, but declared victory over the virus in October the same year. The North has never confirmed the exact number of COVID cases and related deaths. In the Philippines, an Air Force plane crash near the capital, Manila, leaves the pilot and another aviator dead. The aircraft was wrecked after hitting a rice field during training in the town of Pilar in Bataan Province. A military spokesman says a radar lost track of the aircraft 30 minutes after it took off. He said an investigation has been launched to identify the cause of the mishap. The crash comes as rescuers are searching for another plane that went missing in the Philippines' northern mountainous region. Six people, including the pilot, were on board. The search operation has temporarily been halted due to bad weather. Moving on, Iran's intelligence minister has reported the arrest of 12 terrorist teams affiliated with the Israeli spy agency Mossad in the country. Ismail Khatib said the terrorists were planning to carry out operations to avenge the failure of their seditious plots during the recent riots in Iran. He added that intelligence apparatuses could make all those plots futile and nab the terrorists in the short span of time. Khatib noted that Iran's enemies have been seeking to topple the Islamic establishment since the victory of the 1979 revolution. He said the intelligence ministry is always ready to neutralize enemy plots and threats. And Israel has demolished the home of a Palestinian man who was killed by the regime's forces months ago. According to media reports, Israeli forces raided the Shawafat refugee camp in the West Bank early on Wednesday in order to destroy the home of Uday Tamimi, who was shot dead in October. Tamimi was wanted in connection with the killing of an Israeli soldier in a retaliatory attack. Israel's regime regularly demolishes Palestinian homes under different pretexts, including attacks on Israeli forces and settlers. Human rights organizations condemn the Israeli act as collective punishment. The Tel Aviv regime has intensified its crackdown on Palestinians, killing 18 people in the West Bank this year alone. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth. Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started. We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities. However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports. The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the US-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures.
The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades, yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages.
In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports. Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of hand-woven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong, compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Hand-woven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most hand-woven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the US-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the US sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy, but the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the US imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic hand-woven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of handwoven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of handwoven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year, the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. All right, while I take a quick little break here, I'll be back shortly.
Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it.
Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale.
Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these. Now let's check out the production line to see how it's actually made.
The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatin capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients.
So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amounts of those, they bring it to the production line, which we will check out now.
Perhaps the biggest challenge in this production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1000th of a gram.
There's actually very little substance in it. And that is because the capsule filling machine is capable of microdosing, which after we bring the formulated powder from the previous process, this machine can fill this container, this little capsule, with just 10 milligrams worth of powder, formulated powder, which is not a capability that a lot of capsule filling machines are capable of. So once this capsule is filled with our 10 milligrams worth of formulated substance, we then go to the container filling room.
The containers that have been filled with exactly 30 capsules are brought to be labeled, then packaged, to be sent back into the warehouse, to be sent to pharmacies, and get in the hands of patients. But before that happens, they need to go through one final stage of quality assurance. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
And now we're at the quality control lab, and one of the most important quality control procedures that they do is to test the actual performance of the formula and the capsule. So what they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use the lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has these holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. And the residue left by the formula through this inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula. And that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Take care and bye-bye. For our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the knowledge-based industries. The activities of knowledge-based companies are not just limited to Iran's borders. They have also headed to Venezuela to kick off a tech and science fair showcasing Iran's latest technological achievements.
Nearly 80 Iranian firms participated alongside hundreds of Venezuelan companies in the fair. They offered products and services in numerous fields such as oil, gas, health, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, and machinery. The goal is to exchange experiences, knowledge, and services and deepen Iran's trade ties with the Latin American country. The expo was launched by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. During the ceremony, Maduro announced that 4 fuel-efficient Iranian car models would be assembled in his country and released into the Venezuelan market.
One trend we are seeing these days is the increased activity of biotech companies. In fact, right now, knowledge-based products from this sector hold 40% of the country's total pharmaceutical exports to show for it.
That's based on the Association of Manufacturers and Exporters of Medical Biotechnology Products. Biotech refers to the use of living systems and organisms to develop products. According to the association, these products have saved the country millions in foreign exchange. Additionally, these knowledge-based companies have made Iran self-sufficient in biotech production. This sector exports its products to European, Asian, and Latin American countries while competing with other items in the international arena.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Bazaar team, thank you for tuning in and bye for now. Until then.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi. So we said that Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salamullah, they said that we need to make sure that we are clean on Friday. Imam al-Sadiq, he says, فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ يَطَّلِعُ عَلَىٰ أَهْلِ الْأَرْضِ لِيُضَاعَفَ الْحَسَنَاتِ. For Allah looks onto the people of earth to multiply their deeds. So on Friday, when I shower, put perfume, wear beautiful clothes, and Allah sees me in that state, just looking nice and looking clean, Allah will multiply my deeds. So if I, on a normal day, I pray two rak'ah, Allah gives me 10 hasanat. On Friday, He will give me 20. One last thing I want to mention when it comes to general health and public places, and that is a mucus. Okay, it's also another disgusting aspect of a human being that sometimes we indulge ourselves in. Now, it's fine when a person wants to do things on his own when there's no people around. I mean, I have no issue personally. I mean, do whatever you like. But the minute you step outside the house, or the minute there are other people with you, you have to be very careful. Now, especially when it comes to mucus, it's an accumulation of dirt that, you know, gets stuck in the nose. Or it is something that's stuck sometimes in the throat. If you want to take it out, you have to make sure it's done in a proper manner, proper way, away from people. For those who spit, especially in the masjid, then that's a form of disrespect to the masjid itself and to the people with him. And if we look at the narrations in regards to the ways of the Ahl Bayt themselves and how they used to conduct themselves around people. For example, a narrator says, I've never seen Imam Ridha alayhi salam spits in public, like generally, like he would not spit in front of people, not on a street, not on a walk path, or any place where people might be present. He would always do it when he is not seen by people. And this is not just Imam Ridha alayhi salam, it's all the imams. This is how the Ahl Bayt alayhi salam, they used to conduct themselves. Now, we as Muslims, and specifically as Shia, need to follow the ways of the Ahl Bayt. And sadly, I see a lot of people as they walk on the street, they spit, they throw their disgusting extras on the streets. Now, even the names itself is disgusting to mention. I'm going to reserve that to myself and not mention them. But I've seen many people as they walk, they spit in the streets and in front of other people, as other people are walking. That's not a sign of at least civilization, to say the least, rather than a sign of a believer. A mu'min needs to make sure that he's constantly looking good, smelling good, doing good things, not bad things. Recently, I was walking to the shrine of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, and an old lady, she spat in front of everyone on the side. And not only it was disrespectful to the imam, but it was also bad to the people who would have seen such an act, such a sight. So again, we need to follow the tradition and the ways of our imams, alayhim assalam, and maintain the general cleanness and health of public places.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree,
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره، همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another aspect of health, or general health, I should say, is that we need to make sure that animals are also kept away from the things that we consume ourselves or people consume in general. Because animals, as medical science tells us, that they carry themselves, they carry diseases and sicknesses. I mean, they tell us today that coronavirus was picked up by a bat. I'm not sure how accurate that is, but this is what we've been told. The plague was carried by mice, and so on and so forth. So animals do carry diseases. We have to make sure that things that people consume are hidden away from animals, or animals at least kept away. A person came to Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, and he says, I asked him about a mouse or a dog that drinks from oil or yogurt or something that people used to eat. أَيَحَلُّ أَكْلَ Can a man eat it? If, you know, an animal has tried to eat that before. The Imam says, إِنْ كَانَ جَرَّةٌ وَنَحُوهَا فَلَا يَأْكُلُهُ If it was in a container, kept in a container or something, then you should not eat it. Sometimes the animal itself is najis, therefore it becomes najis itself. So it becomes haram to consume. And sometimes if the animal is not najis, obviously there's a health issue in this regard that a person needs to avoid. And then he says, وَلَكِنْ يَنْتَفُعُ بِهِ فِي سِرَاجٍ أَوْ غَيْرَهُ Rather, he can use this oil either to light, to use it as light, because back in the day they would use it for lights and stuff like that, or they use it for other uses, but do not consume it, because consuming it, it either falls into the haram aspect or at least into the disease aspect. So in either way, that me, in my own house, I have to make sure that these things that I consume and eat, at least kept away from animals. If it is for the public, because sometimes we have tanks that are for water, for drinking water for the public. Sometimes we have food placed for the public and what have you. We have to make sure that these are also protected. We have to make sure that they are safe for people to consume, for people to eat. Again, that's also a general instruction from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam when it comes to keeping things clean. And like we said, being clean on a personal level or on a public level is one of the keys of life. One of the keys of life, meaning that me and you, my life depends on it. That if I don't take care of myself or take care of other people, that I could put myself at risk or other people at risk. We'll leave it here and we'll continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.